Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, March 18th, Joe is joined by Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Lecturer of Cognitive Sciences at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and former Fulbright U.S. Scholar to Egypt, Jackie Barry, and Editor-at-Large Columnist Editorial Writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz.
A lot going on in the news, as always is the case, it seems. Some days maybe a little more than others, but here we go. We'll begin with Iran and where we are in this particular situation. And the update this morning is that Israel says that it has killed Iran's intelligence chief. They say this is the latest highest ranking Iranian official targeted in its air war as it escalated attacks in Lebanon that health officials said had killed or injured dozens of people. The Israeli military said in a statement that the Iranian intelligence minister and his ministry had overseen covert operations against Israeli and American targets across the world. Tehran did not immediately comment on the claim. Israel's announcement came a day after it said it had killed Iran's de facto leader, Ali Larijani, whose funeral on Wednesday drew large crowds in Tehran. Early on Wednesday, the Israeli military intensified its attacks on Lebanon, with strikes in Beirut and other major cities, towns, and villages. Israeli warplanes and drones flew low over Lebanon as Israeli troops continued a deeper ground invasion in the south. Here's what else is happening. At least 1,348 civilians in Iran have been killed since the start of the war, Iran's UN representative has told the Security Council. In Lebanon, health officials said more than 900 have been killed. In Israel, at least 14 people have been killed. The Pentagon says 13 American service members have died since the start of the war. Then we talked about this as it was happening yesterday, so I want to get into it a little bit more fully today, which is the resignation of Joe Kent, the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, who became the first Trump administration official to quit in opposition to the Iran war. President Trump later told reporters in the Oval Office that Mr. Kent was weak on security. Now, you may want to ask, if he was weak on security, why he was chosen to be director of the National Counterterrorism Center. That seems like a fair question, but I digress. We'll get to that later. Mr. Trump lashed out again Tuesday at NATO allies, who have rebuffed his request for help opening the Strait of Hormuz, a key shipping lane that has been all but closed because of Iranian attacks, sending oil prices surging. He also said that he was not afraid to put U.S. troops on the ground in Iran. Finally, I think this is the one thing that we'll talk about here before I throw it over to our wonderful panel for them to discuss, again, we look at the price of oil. Oil prices leapt to around $108 a barrel from $103 earlier this morning after Iranian state media officials reported that airstrikes had hit the South Pars gas field, an offshore deposit that stretches from Qatar toward Iran. While these strikes did not directly affect oil production or processing, they show that oil and gas production facilities are increasingly in play in this war. Natural gas prices in Europe also climb. So there's a lot there to pick and choose from. Jackie, would you like to start us off?
Sure. So for one thing, I mean, I believe that so this is a choke point for oil, obviously. But also one of the issues is this is a digital choke point in the sense that there are a lot of fiber optic cables that are going through to these countries, the UAE, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, for example, these Gulf countries. and a lot of traffic is going there. And so the internet and digital traffic cannot proceed if there is even a small damage to one of the cables. It could be catastrophic. And here's what's really scary about that. India could be affected, according to an article I read in the Indian Times. And also Pakistan is very vulnerable. So this is an issue in the strait because, you know, there could be a big issue with these cables, but also they could have damage from an anchor, from a ship's anchor. And it's not very deep. It's only like 100 meters deep or something like that. So, you know, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, they have invested a lot to communicate with the data centers that they have over there. And I think it's a big issue that, you know, these cables are kind of vulnerable. Someone could even go and intentionally sabotage them. So, yes, we have a choke point for oil. I traveled recently. When I put gas in my car before I left, it cost one price. I came back. I was literally in the air when the war started. And it was $35 more to put oil in my vehicle. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous in terms of like how much, how vulnerable the prices are right now.
Vulnerable is a great word because it is, it's just like snapping your fingers and trying to keep track of it is very, very difficult. Jay Jacknowitz.
gosh, there is, there's a lot to unpack. But the thing that, you know, I'm sure Trump would like everyone to ignore, although he keeps talking about it, is the fact that nobody wants to join his war. And, you know, the biggest, I think the vulnerability, the problem, one of the biggest problems with Donald Trump is really being exposed here. I think his whole life, he has relied on other people to bail him out. I think he fancies himself like the ultimate disruptor in the world, and he will just disrupt things for the sake of disrupting them. I'm going to kidnap a president, and I'm going to tank Cuba's economy, and I'm going to threaten to invade Greenland, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. Other people will fix it. They'll figure it out because the world, he knows this, and I don't think he's wrong on this. The impulse of responsible people in the world is to try to figure it out and smooth it over and make it right. And he comes out looking brilliant in the end, to his at least to his fans. A lot of this, is what does work is by accident, often, you know, or by sheer luck. That things do work out. In this case, he's getting a rude awakening. You can't abuse people for really 10 years, the span that he's been a force in politics, and you certainly can't abuse people the way you have abused other nations in the last year and a half by slapping punishing tariffs on them, by threatening an alliance, by threatening invasion, by threatening annexation, by walking away from things, by calling people stupid, by just insulting people right and left, and then say, oh, man, you know, this war, I could really use your help with. Could you put some people in the line of fire?
I hate you. Why aren't you helping me?
Right. Exactly.
I don't understand why you're not helping me.
And he'll just move on, right? Like he'll find a new enemy and he'll just move on, whereas everyone else is stuck, like you said, bailing it out, right? Bailing him out.
And in this case, unfortunately for him and unfortunately for the rest of us, he can't walk away from this.
Right.
He's got an active war going, or as the right wing, for some reason, loves to call it, a kinetic war. And whatever that means, I guess it's supposed to...
I don't know, but it's slightly better than excursion. But
yeah, yes. I guess. and he's got to figure it out, and it's not going well.
I am so impressed that you're talking about any of this as if it actually makes sense in the real world that we all experience. I'm like, I have so much admiration for that and hope that it will become true. I just wanted to weigh in on something that Jackie said, because about the internet and the cabling, and you know, you don't mess with the internet. The internet is critical infrastructure for our world, and literally, much of what we do cannot happen without a robust internet. Now, the internet is certainly, you know, built and managed with some robustness in it, but that cabling is really important. Our satellites are really important. And when we start messing with that, then it's sort of impossible to do things. I mean, we've all had these experiences where there was just some glitch in a software update, and hospitals shut down, airlines shut down. You know, that's just been happening in the last few years. And so, you don't really mess with that. You know, Joe, when you were talking, I was just thinking to myself, Joe, you know, you think about Iran, and I have these, you know, three questions. Number one, what is the plan? What's the plan? What is the purpose of this from the United States perspective? And I keep trying to think to myself, what's any possible positive endgame in this? Okay, so where would we get to be to make this worth it? And I have to say, I'm really challenged by that question. I don't really know the answer to that.
No, and I don't know that there's an answer to it. I think that's being worked on as we go. I don't think there's a secret plan in a drawer that gives a guide as to how this is all going to eventually unfold, right?
Yeah.
I think there are two end goals here that are discernible if he would just, you know, articulate them better and consistently articulate them. One of them is the end of Iran's ability to export terrorism, and the other is the end of Iran's ambitions of developing nuclear weapons. The problem with both of those. With each of those is that to achieve them, you have to do more than what you've done. To end state-sponsored terrorism, you would have to bankrupt the state, and they're not going to be bankrupted. They have oil, they control the strait. When all the dust is settled, Iran is still going to have access to a very healthy income, I think. They're going to have to rebuild a lot of their country, but they're still going to have access, and there's still going to be a dictatorship. As somebody pointed out on the show that was on just before us on the NPR
Morning Edition. Yes,
they're still going to have the Revolutionary Guard is still going to have machine guns. That is all you need to keep a population under control, a population that for the most part isn't armed. So they're still going to run this country unless we go in with a ground war and completely defeat them, which we have seen. Even if you achieve that, you may end up. Contrary to what Joe Kent thinks, you may end up creating by your own actions, not by Israel's actions or anybody else's actions, but by your actions, you may be creating another ISIS. Highly trained people who are used to making money and used to being in control of things. A Revolutionary Guard without a country to run is going to be a Revolutionary Guard that's looking for a revolution to start somewhere. Or an oppression to start somewhere. And as far as the end of the nuclear threat goes, it was mentioned in another story, I think. Are you going to go in and get the material? That's another ground war.
Right.
Yeah, so. It seems to me you're radicalizing another generation.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's a whole generation of people, you know, if you're, when you're bombing schools and you're doing things like this, and then now we have the successor who has lost most of his family and is even more entrenched. I don't see what progress has been made towards... I just don't see what the end game is and how we're moving towards something that's going to lead to more stability. I just don't understand it.
I mean, the one plus for the Trump administration while they're telling their story is of going back to Fran's question of the plan of sort of revising what the plan is that it was to take away any chance that they have to ever make a nuclear weapon again and to kill their military and to kill their munitions. So that seems to have been mostly completed or certainly put a good dent in it. But okay, but it doesn't have a result. It doesn't impact what is happening elsewhere. The problems are still the problems. The issues are still the issues. And that, is the one thing that doesn't seem to enter into this discussion enough when it's brought up and the administration gets defensive, very defensive about how the war is going, because they seem to just want to focus on the air attack and have nothing to do with what is being left. Which, of course, not to say, you know, we told you so, but there were of people like Dan Cain and others who said, okay, but this is what's going to happen.
And it did. Yep. Yeah. You can't. I've read numerous times. You cannot achieve regime change from the air.
Right. Fran?
No, I was going to agree with you. Sorry, I'm hoarse this morning. I was going to agree with you, and I think that you know, regime change, culture change, real change. You know, all of that is not sort of a one and done. It takes a lot of planning, a lot of thought, you know, how do you actually do this kind of stuff? And, yeah, I think that's right. You know, just go in, bomb them, you know, move on to the next thing. You know, I think the comment that, you know, it's, what was I reading the other day? It was like hit and run, right? You know, disrupt and run. And this notion that, you know, just go make a mess of stuff and, you know, somehow it's going to all be better at the end of it and then go make a mess of something else. You know, we're only, I mean, can you believe this? You know, we're only like a little over a year into this. And think about the world compared to the way the world was a year and a half ago.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of unimaginable to me. And you think about this disruption, you look at the reaction of our European allies, people who have been allies with us for, I don't know, you know, almost a century, who are, you know, people we went through World War II with, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there's no trust. And now, you know, Trump is reaping what he sowed, which is, you know, he's just trying to take this you know, really immature, inexplicable behavior, and they're saying, no, you know, I don't feel like doing that. We weren't consulted. We can't see what the plan is. We don't know what benefit this is to our populace. You know, so if you think about sort of the direction this is all going, I mean, to me, it's just unimaginable that things have changed so dramatically in such a short period of time.
I keep clicking my heels, and I just don't go back.
I'm sorry.
You're not getting back. It's like it's that moment when Tim Matheson will appreciate this, when John Belushi
yeah, you know,
screams.
This is a radio day today for me and for all of you. And I was thinking, you know, what positive benefit can I make for my beloved Joe and the listeners and the rest of you? And it's hard to know some days, you know, it's just such a weird time.
You were,
I
heard
just,
a Belushi reference.
It was when Bluto says, are you with me? And he runs out of the room and everybody just sits there. He comes back and he does do a Belushi speech. You know, the other thing that has really just struck me in the last few days was Hegseth's one of Hegseth's many news conferences where he just, you know, is berating the press for not being smart enough. And they asked him specifically about the Strait of Hormuz. And I noticed something about him, and Jacqueline probably has a better handle on this than I do, but there's a tell, and I've mentioned this about the White House spokesperson, Carolyn Leavitt. Hegseth has the exact same tell. When he is lying, when he knows he is trying to, he is saying something that he knows you won't believe because it's not true, but he's going to say it. And you, because you're a journalist, because you're a responsible journalist, you're not going to challenge him on it. You're not going to get into an argument. So he smiles a little. He gets this little twist in his lips and this little glint in his eyes, like, we planned this in the back room.
Like a snidely whiplash kind of thing?
It's not quite, there's no mustache to twirl, but it's a, I'm so smart. Look at how smart I'm about to be. And he'll tell you, we planned this. This is all part of the plan we had. We knew about the Strait of Hormuz. Are you an idiot?
That was Jay Jochnowitz on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, March 18th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, March 19th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois and professor of history and international relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham.
News of the day and what is happening in the world. And so the U.S. is considering new steps on oil as attacks are rattling the energy markets. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that the Trump administration could release more oil from American reserves as it scrambles to avert a sustained energy crisis set off by the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran. The Trump administration says that it is considering these steps. Prices are soaring. And where did Scott Bessent say this? Oh, right. Fox Business News. And the saying that the government may unsanction the Iranian oil that is already being shipped, about 140 million barrels, that the U.S. could also release more oil into its own strategic reserves. The administration appeared to be scrambling for solutions as news of the latest attacks on Gulf energy infrastructure sent the price of Brent crude, the international benchmark for oil, jumping by nearly 10% to $118 a barrel this morning. European natural gas prices surged as much as 30%. The Dow, the markets open at 9:30. Iran was continuing a barrage of attacks on energy infrastructure in the Persian Gulf in retaliation for an Israeli attack on a gas field on Wednesday. Qatar, a major global energy supplier, said that Iranian attacks had damaged gas sites, the world's, including Rosslafen, is that correct? Rosslafen Terminal, the world's largest liquefied natural gas facility. Drone attacks caused fires at two state-owned refineries in Kuwait, and a drone fell at a key energy export terminal in Saudi Arabia. And the United Arab Emirates officials said that the authorities had responded to incidents at gas facilities and an oil field caused by debris from missile interceptions. Still, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth projected confidence at a news briefing at the Pentagon this morning. This is the one Teresa was watching. Telling reporters, quote, "We're winning decisively and in our terms." He declined to offer a timeline when the war might end. That seems to be the way those questions go. "We're doing great. Oh, if we're doing so great, why isn't over? Well, we still have things to do." Okay. So Mr. Hegseth said that the U.S. military had struck over 7,000 targets in Iran since the war started nearly 3 weeks ago, damaging or sinking over 120 Iranian Navy ships and leaving its military ports, quote, crippled. He dismissed discussion of the war's conduct and the possibility that it could expand into a regional conflict as just, quote, noise. You are shaking your head, rightfully so. Bob, we'll start with you.
Well, you couldn't, you probably could not construct a bigger mess than they have right now. And they've done a very poor job of managing this. The United States has never had a good record in asymmetrical warfare. We tend to use big unit warfare. We tend to put big weapon systems in play. And what we're doing in Iran is exactly that. But at some point, some point soon, I think Congress is going to demand some kind of accounting, and that's when we're going to see that all of this firepower can knock out targets, but it really can't change political will, or it can't end the battle the way that the Trump administration thinks it can. Asymmetrical warfare can go on forever, and Iran is one of the best countries in the world at asymmetrical warfare. You know, they have tens of thousands of moored contact mines in the Gulf. That every time the Pentagon games this out, it takes 2 months to get rid of 1,000 mines, and there are tens of thousands of mines. So we're looking at a 2-year project without being shot at. It's just inconceivable that this stuff hasn't really been thought through. Magnetic mines are there. The Shahed drones are incredibly effective, incredibly cheap to produce. This is what the Russians are using in Ukraine, but Iran is the lead manufacturer of these. They actually get components from all over the world, and none of that supply chain has been affected. So, you know, underwater drones that can avoid acoustic detection. There's just so much left here that's not said and that is undone. United States yesterday just began to move a Marine Expeditionary Unit into the Gulf area, led by the U.S. Tripoli. This is an amphibious-ready group. It usually has about 2,000 Marines attached to it. And if I was a member of Congress in the Armed Services Committee or the Foreign Relations Committee, I would have Hegseth in a hearing, and I would ask him, how many divisions is it going to take until you can claim political military victory, if that's really what you're saying you've done? And the answer is going to be probably 20, and that's 200,000.
That's fascinating. And I apologize for being cynical, but do you really think he would know that?
No, he wouldn't know that. In fact, I think that they're.
I don't mean.
You know, that's the trouble with this administration.
Right.
You don't know where they are on a map in any given day, but they've just moved. You know, moving a Marine Expeditionary Unit into the area is a precursor to a ground Marine invasion.
Yes.
And that
is
a slippery slope.
Can I ask, what I'm unclear about is where will the boots be on the ground? I mean, I know in the Straits that there is one area they were talked about, but where, because this is such a disparate, areas of attack.
Yeah, and it's one of the most inhospitable coastlines to try to attack, to try to land.
And what are they going to attack? Are they going to take over the oil fields? I truly don't understand.
I don't either. I mean, I think that's the problem, and they don't understand, and that's the bigger problem.
Yeah.
But if you had an interest in, which this administration doesn't, if you had an interest in history and the history of this kind of aerial attack, you'd read
bombing surveys, right?
You'd understand that in World War II, bombing was going to take you so far, but eventually you had to land Patton. You had to get down with heavy mechanized units to roll across Europe. You don't need heavily mechanized units in this theater of operation, but you are, to achieve the objectives that they keep saying they want to achieve, you're going to have boots on the ground.
Well, Senator Mark Kelly, who was a Navy pilot bomber, has said that over and over again. Yes. In the last week, that you can't do what they claim they're trying to do without boots on the ground. You can't do this from the sky, is what he keeps saying.
Yeah, and let me take that one step further and say that
they've been saying since the beginning.
They have been saying from the beginning. And the bombing surveys from World War II show the same thing. All the national intelligence estimates and the Jason studies from Vietnam show the same thing. You cannot achieve your geostrategic objectives with high-level bombing. It doesn't work. And so, you know, this is a slippery slope. My guess is that they won't go too far down that lane because they're going to have such a mess of other problems that the first caskets coming home in high numbers might chill this. But with this administration, they're totally unpredictable.
So I have so many follow-up questions, as I know Teresa does as well. We're gonna take a break for a second. And we'll get some news from the BBC, some updates on what is happening in the world, including what's happening in Iran and the latest bombings. We'll hear about that as well. But I also I want to get to the price of oil, I also want to get to the just this idea of if you keep saying that we're winning. I don't know what the definition of that is when we seem to be in the quote unquote mess that you have just laid out. That seems to be the mess that most experts are laying out. That I think is obviously what so many of us are greatly concerned about. And if it is going so great, then why is all that other stuff happening? At the beginning of the show, as I was reading from the New York Times, their coverage of this, and specifically as to oil and the use of the reserves, and it seems the word that came up several times during that was scrambling, and this administration has been scrambling over the last week and a half, 2 weeks over oil prices, and various reserves and various ideas have come into fruition, and various tariffs and so forth have been removed to try to improve that. Are we seeing any impact on those efforts? Because it seems like the price just keeps to be going up when all of these things are being done, being sort of thrown at the wall to see what sticks. Is anything sticking?
I'm listening to a few different experts. I had heard over and over again that even if they make these adjustments, it'll take 6 months or more. Even if this thing stopped now, it would take 6 months or more to recalibrate, to deal with what is happening in the oil markets. And I think it's interesting to know that the Japanese prime minister is at the White House today. She's visiting in the U.S., and I heard some TV coverage of they have record fuel prices there, gas prices there. And so this war is not their war, but it's impacting their wallets. And all over the world, you hear different stories of rationing or some governments closing their offices early or asking people to conserve. I don't hear the president asking people in the U.S. to conserve. But this is a global oil shock. And given the bombings that you talked about over the during the night, I think that's only going to, the destruction of this core infrastructure, it's only going to escalate and get worse. And that raises the broader question of the U.S. dependence on oil as opposed to clean energy and other forms of energy. We were moving away from that for a long time, and President Trump really stopped all those efforts and put big bets on oil, and probably closely related to remember the famous meeting when he was running for office and he met with the key oil companies, and they gave him $1 billion and he focused on that business. But I think that for our own national safety and our own economic security, we really need to move away from this. Data point that I heard the other day is that this issue of whether or not these oil tankers should be moving through the straits, right? The Strait of Hormuz. And one of the issues is, can they be insured to do so? And so Trump administration said, well, we'll provide reinsurance. We'll provide insurance. But the price tag for that, for the American taxpayers, is $20 billion. So $20 billion of our money to provide insurance for these oil companies that are making enormous amounts of money to protect them from the decisions that the Trump administration made to go in and without realizing that the Straits of Hormuz would be closed. But as was pointed out in a hearing yesterday, if you just read last year's national security report, it's right in there.
I mean, no matter, we try to keep the topics unfolding as we go, but they're so linked that it's difficult to do that. But at some point, we can talk about it in depth. Meanwhile, they're going to ask for another $200 billion.
That $200 billion is on top of $1.5 trillion, which is a huge increase year on year. And most of that $200 billion is for replacement weapons that they've used in this bombing and used in Ukraine. You know, that we're down our interceptors, which intercept, you know, incoming missiles.
At a
down,
price tag of roughly.
Yeah, down 25%. New Tomahawks, new Patriots. So this is just replacing hardware with hardware. That doesn't change the problem. No. You're not going to bomb yourself out of this problem. It just isn't, you know, the Trump administration thought that they could do this. They thought they could do this on the cheap. And now they're slowly, well, maybe they're not understanding, but we're slowly understanding that this has enormous ripples. It's not just the oil prices, it's gas prices. It's fertilizer. A third of the world's fertilizer goes through the Gulf. And in 2 weeks, if plants aren't fertilized in the Northern Hemisphere, there's going to be malnutrition. There'll be pocket starvation.
Well, I mean, think about the agriculture community in this country and around the world, but just think about American farmers and what the assaults on American farmers, immigrant crackdown. They don't have workers because they can't get the people coming in legally as they had in the past. With the tariffs that has, with the cut in USAID programs, it cuts out a lot of their markets in both cases. And now they can't even get fertilizer for their farms. I mean, this is just a tremendous economic blow here and around the world.
In the Trump administration's efforts to keep gas prices from going, you know, from doubling in the next 2 months, this idea that you're going to allow Russia to release sanctioned oil for a short period of time, that's gone. Russia is back on the oil market, and which means they can sustain the war in Ukraine forever. They can disrupt other parts of the region that are going to be vital to U.S. security interests. China gets 17.7% of its oil from Russia. It gets 14.9% of its oil from Saudi Arabia. It only gets 10% from Iran.
But think about the fact that the Trump and Vance administration lifted the sanctions on Russia is just stunning.
It's mind-boggling.
Lifted the sanctions on Russia and filled their coffers with money.
And just to double down and make sure you get all of this right, in the hollowing out of U.S. capacity in international affairs included the only person in the State Department that tracks sanctioned supertankers. He no longer works for the government.
That was Robert Brigham on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, March 19th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, March 20th, Joe was joined by the Ulster County Comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, Mark Gallagher, a professor in the History Department at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Allison Cavey, the founder and director of the Volunteer Literacy Project, is also a columnist for the Free Press and a Greene County resident, Larissa Phillips, and executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Oil prices remain high as more attacks are reported in the Mideast. The price of oil eased only slightly after the Trump administration sought to calm the markets. A drone attack caused fires in a major Kuwaiti oil refinery for a second straight day. But the price of oil remained elevated as investors feared that the wide-ranging attacks on energy infrastructure in the Persian Gulf, including a drone strike on a Kuwaiti oil refinery, would have long-term economic consequences. This reporting from the New York Times. The war in the Middle East cast a pall over celebrations of a holiday marking the end of Ramadan, of the Ramadan fasting month, as well as the Persian New Year. A somber mood prevailed over family gatherings across the region as the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran neared its fourth week. Iran fired more retaliatory strikes, with several U.S. allies saying they were responding to incoming drones and missiles. The state-owned Kuwait Petroleum Corporation said a drone attack had caused fires at a refinery for the second consecutive day. Israel said it had launched targeted attacks on Tehran after Iranian missile fire set off sirens in Jerusalem and northern Israel overnight. In Washington on Thursday, a day after airstrikes on critical gas infrastructure in Qatar and Iran, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said the United States was, quote, planning to lift sanctions on Iranian oil in an effort to shore up the global market, reversing years of U.S. measures to cripple Tehran's economy. President Trump said he had told Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel to stop attacking Iran's energy fields. He also tried to reassure Americans on the economic impact of the war, saying on Thursday, it will be over soon. He did not explain. He also said he wouldn't send ground troops into Iran, but left room to change his mind. On Friday, benchmark stock indexes were higher in South Korea and China, and the price of Brent crude was edging higher after falling from a high of $119 a day earlier. And a sign of the war's long-term repercussions, state-owned, I just lost my page. Oh, dear. State-owned Qatar Energy said that it would take up to 5 years to repair extensive damage to gas facilities damaged by attacks this week. Qatari officials blamed the strikes on Iran, which had vowed to retaliate against an earlier attack on its largest gas field, one it blamed on Israel. There is much, much more to talk about in the regards of new attacks and the U.S. war effort, as well as the war budget. They're seeking another $200 billion for this war, the death toll. There's a question about jet fuel. There are a lot of topics that we can discuss. But that is the rundown as it stands right now, as I turn it over to our esteemed panelists and begin with March Gallagher.
Thank you, Donald Trump, for high gas prices today and for years to come, because this is not going to be over right away. Even if they reach some sort of ceasefire agreement tomorrow, it's going to take years to rebuild capacity at these oil fields and these processing complexes. So we're looking at extended, you know, periods of time with higher gas prices. I read that 17% of the capacity at that Ras Laffan industrial complex in Qatar was damaged. That's $20 billion in production, annual production. So we're really looking at something that's going to take a long time to fix. And I don't think that them lifting sanctions on Iran is going to really do a significant have a significant impact on oil prices globally. I think, yeah, maybe it'll soften it a little bit, but we're still looking at over $100 a barrel. This is going to empower Iran. We're literally going backwards here in our policy, right? We're going to allow them more income to do what they want with. And, you know, I was listening this morning probably with our other listeners about how this war and the way it's playing out is really going to drive the desire of Iran to have nuclear weapons long term, because that is going to be the only way that they can protect themselves going forward. So I think lifting sanctions on Iran is a huge mistake. I think China is benefiting here at our expense and high prices for oil and gas in Europe. And I think that we're going to see years and years of high prices here. And that doesn't even get to the loss of life, which is absolutely tragic. Not just our own service people, but also, you know, over 1,300 Iranians and 1,000 Lebanese people. It's a tragedy, and it's going to have cost impacts for years to come.
Allison.
I just want to speak to this ongoing nuclear escalation because, yes, we are encouraging Iran to continue to develop its nuclear program, which we could have, in fact, you know, continued to not encourage by staying in the 2018, when we left the Iranian nuclear agreement in 2018 under Trump, one. But we're also increasing our own uranium enriching capacity. There was a story on NPR this morning about a small town in Tennessee that just was shocked to find that a company was coming in and developing a uranium enrichment plant that would significantly affect the environment and the health of the people in that area. And the town board of governors has to approve it. And they're being told, oh, well, it will bring 175 jobs, so you should just be quiet. And this is a huge amount of local investment for this small town in Tennessee. This is the kind of long-term escalation of nuclear development that we have been trying to avoid for the last 50 years. It's insane to consider increasing uranium development in the United States and to really re-enter the nuclear escalation process because we have a president and a secretary of toys who likes to play with his extensive toy collection and has almost no knowledge of the geopolitical implications and is essentially splashing around trying to see what might happen if he can decimate the entire existing world structure and enrich himself and his allies.
As I mentioned, we are talking about the Iran war. We are talking about the latest updates. Oil prices, of course, remaining high, and more attacks are happening as we speak. We have heard from Marsh Gallagher and Allison Cavey, and we go to Larissa Phillips.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to push back a little bit because I'm as horrified by war, and I appreciate the anti-war sentiment in the U.S. Like, it's so important always to have that. But I also am very moved by the plight of the Iranian people, that they've been living under this repressive regime for 45 years. There was a massive massacre in January, and I was watching that unfold just absolutely horrified by over 30,000 people just shot, massacred. You know, the police were going into hospitals and killing protesters, and they were killing doctors and nurses. And the Iranian people seem to want to get rid of this regime. And as much as scared as I am and as much trepidation as I have about ground troops and about the escalation of the war and the continuation of the war, I really want the U.S. to win. And I would love to see a different regime, a different political system over there.
May I ask you what you how you deem winning?
I
only say that because there seems to be one of the controversies of this war is that many are looking at the administration saying there's no clear plan. We don't know what the outcome they're going for is. So I'm just curious as to what of how you would define winning.
Well, in my dreams, it would be a coalition would rise from the Iranian people to take over. Of course, that's very difficult to imagine happening. But I would define losing as that regime continuing. So I think that some energy needs to be put into that possibility of some kind of alternate regime. And I mean, the idea of a peaceful Iran, of a democratic Iran, is just very appealing.
Nick Rangel.
I take a lot of issue with the notion that the U.S. is going into Iran to liberate the people of Iran in order for Iran's protest movements to create a new government. For one thing, in the last 10 years, there have been at least 4 massive protest uprisings against the current administration in Iran, and the U.S. has done literally nothing to support or assist those Iranians. And if you have allowed for tens of thousands of protesters to be killed, arrested, disappeared, or otherwise, who is left to then start a fresh, new, energized democratic regime? particularly when it can't rely on the U.S. to support or promote its democratic efforts going forward. There are other countries that have elected, democratically elected leaders that the U.S. have toppled as well. So there's not even a guarantee that the U.S. will approve of whomever the people of Iran do actually put into power. Not only that, Iran's government has such a massive bureaucratic overlay that you would have to demolish the entirety of its government from the ground up in order to start from the ground up. And what we're seeing in the United States is, as we're demolishing our own government, we know that it's going to take decades to rebuild what we have left. And I think the idea that there's a winning in Iran in any short term, less than 20-year period, is exceptionally, exceptionally unlikely.
Yes, we all want a peaceful, democratic Iran. The problem is that the cost to get that is just too high. And we haven't had the public debate. We haven't had the conversation about what the war is going to look like and what we have to give up to get there. The risk of further conflagration is way too high here. And we haven't had Congress, approve a declaration of war. Now, my memory, and, you know, I'm not that old, but my memory of previous, quote, engagements was that presidents hesitated to use the word war because they didn't have a declaration of war. Later on in popular culture, we refer to it as, you know, the Iraq War, okay? But at the time, we weren't using that language. We have not had sufficient debate in Congress to justify the use of resources and the loss of lives that is occurring right now. And I say this because we were just talking, Joe mentioned it a minute ago, we're going to, you know, they're asking for $200 billion now to do this. Let's not forget, and I keep going back to it, SNAP benefit cuts, $186 billion over 10 years. So I can find the SNAP benefits funding right now. Let's just not do the war. So I just feel like this has not had sufficient public debate. It has not had sufficient congressional conversation. We have not seen the administration make the case to the American people or to Congress. And Congress, in its role here, is failing as an institution. Congress has failed as a branch of government. I think we have to face the reality here that Congress is not doing its job. We can complain that the Supreme Court and is weighted towards Trump and he's had a lot of appointees, but the bottom line is the courts have pushed back against the Trump administration time and time again, including Trump appointees. I'm not saying everything's cool there, but at least we see some resistance, some separation from the administration. Congress has completely rolled over and is just not doing what it needs to do here. So the cost is just too high for the potential idea that peace could occur that we want. It's just too high.
In fact, trillions of dollars to completely topple the current government in Iran with a ground invasion, right?
But also, we're not creating the kind of popular movement in Iran that would encourage the development of a democratic republic. In fact, what we're encouraging is radicalization and violence by going to war and killing large numbers of people. What we're doing is making the United States look like a bully that has no coherent international policy. And while it's true that I would like to see a democratic Iran, I don't think the people in Iran right now see me or anybody else in this country as advocating for that. And I think it's worth reminding ourselves that the majority of people who voted for this president did not want any international engagements. They voted for him to make, quote, America first. And now, in fact, what we're doing is spending more and more money on international engagements that are going to have long-term negative implications for the international community, that are going to detract from the United States' diplomatic policies and ability to be a world power and a meaningful world power. And we're also going to see the long-term financial consequences for the United States, not just in the decimation of our benefits, but also in things like higher fuel prices for people who are farmers. Well, they voted. Farmers disproportionately voted throughout the Midwest, throughout the South, for Trump. And now fertilizer is much more expensive. Diesel is much more expensive. Seed is much more expensive. This isn't what they voted for.
I don't know if it's true that there's no coalition in Iran that's in favor of this. I think there's actually like quite a lot of people who are very, very excited about this happening and are really supporting America.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that might be true, but that doesn't necessarily mean that like we had a right to go and engage in a bombing campaign without any democratic process in the United States and no democratic process in Iran, and doing so in alignment with Israel's goals, not the goals of Iran. Right. Like if we're saying we were going in to support Iranians, we would have collaborated with Iranians. We would not have collaborated with the Israeli government to impose upon Iranians our vision for their future.
And also Netanyahu has no long term focus for democracy in Iran or anywhere else.
I just want to say I have seen interviews with Iranians who were saying that they were sort of hopeful that this would result in regime change. And I wish that the action that was taken had been taken closer to the demonstrations. I think that would have been a stronger message of trying to support the uprising that was, you know, potentially maybe going to occur in Iran.
A lot of people were really frustrated that the U.S. waited so long while watching all of those protests. Absolutely.
I mean, we remember that
tortured. Yeah. We waited for
but,
them
but
to
so
be
then
tortured.
I don't get it. Like, should they have done it earlier or should they have done it later? So they did it later. I mean, would you have been happier if they did it earlier?
I would not have been happy with them doing this at all. This is a terribly considered, ill-conceived, poorly constructed effort to essentially get real estate for Netanyahu.
I would have been much more comfortable, and I'm basically just a peace-loving person to begin with, sort of an anti-war person to begin with, but I would have been a lot more comfortable had there been really an exercise of debate in Congress and in the country. That would have given me a little bit more comfort than what we have right now. Yeah, so the waiting time, if it had been used for that conversation for a conversation with the American people and for engaging Congress, I would have better understood the wait. Instead, there was sort of silence during that period, but it wasn't totally silent, right? Pundits were saying, oh, we're going to go to war with Iran. People were gambling.
Well, you saw ships moving and obviously the chessboard was being set up. I do think, I mean, I don't really like this term of selling the war. I don't like that. I don't like that. But I do feel there was a lack of that a lot of what we're going through now with our allies, with the American people, with the understanding of what's happening with oil prices, of what's happening in our relationship with the Israeli government, of what that situation is. And that would go into the preamble to a war.
Absolutely. I think there should have been much more discussion. I agree. I absolutely agree with that.
Can I just add, Joe, I think one of the things that's really missing is that we keep saying, like, well, the Trump administration isn't clear about their goals. Is it to prevent nuclear proliferation? Is it to destroy ballistic missile capability? Is it to, you know, encourage a new regime there? And I think that if there had been a robust conversation, there would actually be a way to tie a thread to all of those goals. I think a sophisticated approach would have been able to sort of make all of those arguments in a concrete way. And that just hasn't happened. So it seems like they're just hopscotching from goal to goal when maybe there is a through line that hasn't been made here. And I think the time that would have been necessary to do that was wasted doing other things and really could have been taken up during that several month period.
I also think there's been a lot of like even victim blaming of Iranians who have found themselves dead because of U.S. attacks, like the children's school, the girls' school that we accidentally bombed, right? There has not been any effort by this administration to apologize, to rectify, to even admit that it made such a severe mistake. And so when we're saying, well, we're really going in to be helpful and we want to help Iranians, but then we also just dodge any accountability for mistakes that we make in that effort, it just diminishes the integrity of those claims.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Friday, March 20th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.